Hello, my name is Dave Hanrady and there will be no encore. Welcome to The Revisit, in which we go back in time to assess Irish albums past. The year is 1999 and I've got a great panel with me today. I have Ed Smith of Today FM.
How are you?
Panicked there, so I did.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah,
I doubted myself there briefly.
Proper radio DJ.
Are we really here?
I got scared. And we have Elaine May back on the show. How are you, Elaine?
Good. Good to be here.
Kieran McGuinness, as always.
Hello there.
And journalist and presenter of the award-winning Fair Game podcast, Elaine Buckley.
Thanks for slipping that in there, Dave. Appreciate it.
It's award-winning. Go check it out, listeners. But not until you hear this episode, which centres around 1999. Kieran, what was going on in the world of pop culture?
Pop culture, okay. So films was American Beauty, The Matrix, Being John Malkovich, Magnolia, The Insider.
Fight Club.
Fight Club. Shit, I didn't write that down. Fight Club.
Three Kings.
Great
year.
Yes, loads of films like that. And in music, Soft Bulletin, 69 Love Songs, Rage Against the Machines, Battle of Los Angeles, Sigur Rós's debut, Pavement's Terror Twilight, The Fragile, Nine Inch Nails, Midnight Vultures, The Hot Mess by Beck, Slim Shady's album. Anything else that anyone remembers?
No.
TLC's Fan Mail.
Oh, yeah.
Hit Me Baby One More Time, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm. Solid, solid year. Very good year.
Robbie Williams' debut album as well came out that year as well.
Life Through Lens, was it?
As a young Take That fan was a pretty big one. People like me.
It was pretty hit and miss for him. It looked like it was going to be pretty hit and miss at the start. He had that terrible cover of something and then...
Oh, George Michael, Freedom.
And then there was all the like getting drunk with Oasis and everything and then Angels came along and that was it.
Changed his life.
Mario Rosenstock tells a story of in and around that period before Angels. He was having a drink in the front lounge. I think it wasn't that long open. And he thought it was this homeless guy was just harassing people for cigarettes or light of his. Dressed up in a tracksuit. And Mario just kind of like, not now, thanks. It was Robbie Williams in his kind of mad phase before he kind of hit the big time. And people were kind of turning their back on him. Even if they recognized him, they're going, oh God, it's that Egypt from Take That. And little did they realize they could have lit a cigarette of a superstar.
Yeah, no selfies back then. Jesus.
Thank God, yeah.
Imagine that. Robert Williams, I don't know. I kind of had a bit of a soft spot for him and I've been pilloried for saying that. I thought like his second album was quite good. Millennium?
Is that Millennium, what it
was? Yeah. No Regrets is a fantastic song.
It's a brilliant song.
It's a great song. Yeah.
Okay, we'll agree on that. as well as that, Sopranos started as well as Family Guy. Jordan, you know, Michael Jordan retired. Bill Clinton impeachment started against him. And obviously Tony Blair and John Bruton were in charge in Ireland and the UK. So it was kind of very much the turn of the sort of the millennium and everything. There was loads of albums called, there was the Willennium.
Millennium.
Yeah. There was Millennium and then there was a couple of those. And there was a song called Millennium. So a lot of people were obsessed with it. 1999 was on the radio a lot. Disco 2000 was on the radio a lot. So it was around
Maniac
that time.
2000 as well, don't forget.
Maniac 2000.
Well, it's on the air always, but like, you know, that was particularly prescient year for Maniac 2000.
Yeah, maybe. I thought that was much... Oh, no. The remix was 2000, wasn't it? Wasn't it like released in like 94?
We'll have to get Mark McCabe on the phone. I'm not entirely sure.
Anyway, so there was a lot like... What going on in the film The Matrix? They say that they designed The Matrix in the year 1999 because it was the pinnacle of human kind of culture or whatever. It was before everything happened and all.
Before the Y2K bug was going to destroy the entire.
But you
universe.
Know, I mean, like if you think about it, I mean, there is something about 1999. It was before, you know, maybe air travel went down the toilet because of whatever else. You know, it was at the time where the internet had this huge sort of possibility before it just...
Whatever happened to the internet?
No one ever talks about it anymore, yeah.
Well, you know, before now, it's like, you know, it's the bane of people's existences as well as, you know, great. Great for Wikipedia for things like this.
Wasn't Napster founded in 1999, though? As well, that's just after popping into my head, 1999.
Probably. Oh, that's actually, around that time.
Which obviously changed music dramatically
as well. Yeah, so I guess... Yeah, it's just after the big after Britpop, which was this huge, you know, revitalization or whether it was or not, but of British music and like, obviously Irish music in the same kind of world. So, you know, after OK Computer, you know, so there was a lot of stuff being written around that time. You would think the music would be of incredible quality.
Mm-hmm. Oh, also, sorry, the Blair Witch Project was 1999.
I love the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah, man, and I remember going to see that with my sister, my then 25-year-old sister, who cried hysterically all the way home. Sorry for bringing that up, Emma.
Rightly so. It's still one of the scariest films I've ever
seen.
That
ending, man, like to this day, I think about that at 2 in the morning, and that's me awake for the rest of the night.
Yeah. So the ending of that Is that the Stand Against the Wall?
Spoilers for for an almost 20-year-old movie, but yeah, it is. So it's left to your imagination as to what's happening, and that's the real scary.
It's a great horror film. It's brilliant. Blair Witch, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. It's awesome. Did you see the sequel / remake?
No, we don't talk about that.
Not good, not good. I was so let down. Anyway, here at home, Kieran, what is going on?
I don't know.
Jesus.
Oh, do you mean...
We have a short list of albums that we have to talk about today. That's the whole show. It's actually the episode, because every act on here starts with a the.
Yeah, random. So there's five albums that we've chosen. We whittled down from a pretty big list. So The Prayer Boat and Polichinelle, and The Four of Us and Classified Personal, The Frank and Walters, Beauty Becomes More Than Life, The Plague Monkeys, Sunburn Index, and The Frames, Dance the Devil.
Yeah, I expected more of a kind of, I don't know, vivid year for music or something. I think it goes into that whole 1999 thing and just remembering it and kind of like getting into music kind of probably around the time, listening to the radio a lot. But like the albums that we kind of came to were a lot more kind of, I guess, indie-ish. But
yeah,
that's fine.
There's a lot of alternative stuff on the list, yeah.
Yeah, but we'll see. What didn't make it?
Well, what didn't make it, and I guess we could go around the table a little bit, but Mary Black was chosen by a few people to listen to and it didn't get through. So what was the feelings there? Anyone have any thoughts on it?
The cover of Crowded House Falls Your Feet, that's one of my favourite songs of all time. I never realised she'd actually covered it, and I heard it and it's just absolutely rotten.
It was her second album. I think she'd released Shine, or it was her first American attempt to break the American market. Didn't quite work. So she kind of stripped things back, I think, to kind of bring it back to whatever it is, the essence that Mary Black had or has. And she was saying earlier, when I was growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, Mary Black was one of the four CDs or tapes even then that every house had. She was monolithic in this country. So it was fine, you know, kind of mystical Celtic hogwash for a lot of it. But I still like her, and I know her daughter, so I'd better be careful.
But it was funny because when I looked it up, there's an aggregator of albums and all and reviews or whatever else, and one of them had the highest rated Irish album that year was the Mary Black album, so it got amazingly well reviewed. Another one was the Adrian Crowley album, and you listened to that one, Dave.
Yeah, I thought it was good, because I kind of was thinking, he's won the Choice before, right? Was he the first one to ever win it? So I kind of was like, oh, actually...
No, but...
Oh, I thought he was. I was kind of like unfamiliar with him, so I kind of gave it a go. I mean, it's not anything groundbreaking or anything, but I thought it had a little bit of character work in there that I quite liked. And actually, like, the idea of kind of character work will come up in one of these records where I thought it was lacking. Not that his was blow away, but I can see why it didn't make it. I just thought it had a little bit of charm.
Anything else anyone wants to throw in?
I quite liked the Mary Black album, but then when I got to that cover as well, I was like, not sure. And it kind of put me off. But it's really well produced and her voice is amazing. So
but
Dawn
Lunny's
like
on
one.
It. I mean, there's some great serious musicians on it.
I'd say she'd be
a great production.
Call on a spectacular lineup for these things.
Cranberries Bury the Hatchet as well. Didn't make it. Difficult record, I would say. Often cited as a bit of a tricky one, I think.
Well, the funny thing about it is, for Cranberries fans, they say this, that that's one of the favourites of their whole career, is that one. And so I kind of went into it thinking, oh, well, I assumed it would be one that people would choose, because often there's one big name that gets in because, you know, it's one that everyone kind of spends time with. And I wasn't a fan.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, no, me neither. And I'd be very much a retrospective Cranberries fan, because they just weren't of my era when like in 93 and 94, when they released kind of their two bigger albums with all their huge songs on it. So I kind of went into listening to this one expecting even one track along those lines, and it just nothing kind of struck me as much.
I heard it twice and I still can't remember a single song. Well, that is
like you're looking for something that packs a punch, like a How or a Linger or a Dreams, and it's just
one of my dad's favourite bands, Cranberries, which is pretty random. You'll be in the kitchen singing Linger and I'll be like
it's a good song, it holds up. But do The Frames hold up? Let's have our first album on this list. Let's listen to Pavement Tune by The Frames.
This situation's killing me, it's got me right under the phone. I don't know where I wanna be. This doesn't make no sense at all. You're quoting every single line. I spoke too much, but I was old before my time, you told me. You see, I want my life to make more sense. I want my life to make amends.
So that's Glenn Hansard and The Frames, as I like to call them, with Dance the Devil. I gotta confess, The Frames were a band that I've never quite gotten the full appeal of. For some people in this country, it's a religion. Elaine May, where do you stand on The Frames?
Well, I had actually never heard this album before at all. To be honest, I'd never heard any of these albums because when I was 15, I was pretty much strictly into metal music and spent a lot of time listening to Korn and Marilyn Manson and stuff. So all this stuff just passed me by completely. So when you guys asked me to do this and I looked at the list, I was like, right, well, this will be an education. So I've learned a lot about Irish music in the last week and a half. But yeah, it's a really good album. I really enjoyed it from start to finish. It's really complete. I think the journey through it is really good as well. I think it's really rich and I really like his voice. So as someone who has no experience with it whatsoever, I really liked it.
Fair enough. Ed, are you a Frames guy?
They kind of bypassed me as well. I was 23 in 1999. I think maybe it's a typical Irish thing, but like, I think the religious fervour that the Frames fans had for the Frames in some kind of awful inverse snobbery kind of put me off, which is very typical Irish thing
That's
to say.
That's very Irish.
And it is, and to my great shame, because I do like them, but I think that kind of maybe made me keep away from them for some years, so it was good to go back. And I really enjoyed this experience, and I want to thank you for it, because I haven't heard a full album, because of the nature of my job, I have to listen to songs, and then you don't have much time to kind of sit back and kind of let an album percolate, because there's always something else coming in or being sent to you. So, as we mentioned, the start of Napster back in 99, of course, maybe that was the beginning of the end for maybe people listening to full albums, and I think that listening to The Frames and Dance the Devil, it really is, as Elaine says, the kind of perfectly curated and kind of thought out sequentially realised album. That's the most wanky thing I'd probably hopefully say for the rest of this podcast. But, you know, with the start of it, perfect opening line is the perfect opening line to the album. And I think it's the best of The Frames. You know, it kind of shows their variety and a lot of their ambition. I think they were having problems with the record label around this time, and there's a lot of anger in there, which always makes for some of singers and bands' best albums. We'll get to the Franks later on. I think they were having problems as well. So you can hear a lot of the anger there, but this is kind of very subtle songs like Star Star. And it's been so long since I haven't heard the live version of Star Star. Because, you know, when we play Evil on the Station or you hear it, it's always that kind of...
The one mixed with the...
With the imagination on, yeah. on the violin. So it's even a bit more stripped back and a little gentler version of it. And it doesn't have that live element to it. So it's nice to hear that again. I think it's probably their best album. People would say Fitzcarraldo, but I think it's probably the most Framesy album. And if you're a fan of The Frames, then I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, I agree with so much of what you just said there, particularly kind of coming to them with that kind of skepticism, because I do find that like Frames fans are a particular kind of breed, I suppose. And I mean, like, I've heard stories about Frames gigs and just how kind of precious it all is. I mean, like there is a line that can be crossed, which was crossed physically by one of my brother's friends when they played the Spirit Store in Dundalk around this time, probably actually, where like apparently during one of their songs it was like a real deep moment and they were just letting it breathe, and one of my brother's mates leaned over and like went "Hring!" on one of the guitars, which was, you know, not cool. Don't do it. But I thought, if you're going to do it at any gig, that's probably the one to do it at. You know? But I mean, I just kind of find with The Frames, like, I don't quite get it. And with Glenn Hansard, like, I don't really get it. And I find him, his kind of balladeer side, which I guess is most of what he does, just doesn't do it for me. I think there's a massive ego there that I don't really feel is backed up in the music. And what I do like about this record, though, as you say, is there's anger. I think The Frames are best when they're at their kind of raw edges and they're a bit punchy and he's a bit pissed off. And it kind of sounds like they're not afraid to experiment. It does sound like kind of lads in a practice room, but obviously well, well produced. When they get into the more kind of confessional stuff, it loses me. But songs at Pavement Tune, even The Stars Are Underground, I think is really a good number as well. I mean, like, I try and come to records that I know I'm going to be cynical about, and I do my best to kind of fight that. And on this one, I mostly kind of won. I actually kind of came away from this thinking it is a really good record, but I do find those little kind of moments where it gets all kind of quiet and personal in that kind of Glenn Hansard TM way just loses me a little bit.
I think the problem with Hansard, some people have, well, I have, I should say, I'm not going to put it on other people's shoulders, is that it's a fine line between sincerity and earnestness.
Sure.
And I think that as time has gone on, maybe, he has crossed that Rubicon into earnestness, and Irish people being who they are, myself included, we'll throw the two fingers up pretty quickly. Which is unfair of me, really, because, like I say, it was good to go back and go, actually, do you know what? They have some wonderful songs, and this is a great album. So I hold my hands up and I confess.
I would be very much of the opinion that The Frames are probably one of my favourite bands. Tough crowd here in this room. But again, I like when Dance the Devil came out, I wouldn't have heard it in the year that it came out. The first Frames album that I heard would have been For the Birds, which was in 2001. And then I loved that so much that I, you know, went back to back to listen to their previous stuff. Obviously, Fitzcarraldo was 95, and then Dance the Devil, which is the one that we've all listened to now. I think when listening to the Frames, and in particular when listening to Dance the Devil as a body of work, I love the way the album is structured, but also a big part of the draw for the Frames for me is their live setting and a lot of my favourite songs, and I've seen them God knows how many times. Now, I'm not one of those, you know, religious experience fans who's been there since, if they were busking on the street or whatever, since I've been old enough to go to their shows. But, you know, songs like Stars Are Underground is just such a cracker of a song live that when you actually listen to it as part of the album again, it just brings that kind of energy and that grow that I have for the Frames out again. And one of my favourite songs of theirs is 7 Day Mile, which is situated very nicely on this album. So,
yeah, that's a great track.
Like, it's funny, I thought I was going to come in and say a certain thing because the thing that I think is exactly what you said, Dave. I love the band Going For It songs.
Yeah.
I really don't like the really intimate, like, it feels a little bit like I'm in the pub is closed, you know, everyone's passing the guitar around, and whatever reason Glenn has sat beside me and he's singing just into my ear and I can feel his breath on my neck. And songs like,
oh, that's creepy.
Yeah. Songs like Star Star are just so, you know, he's almost whispering. He's, you know.
Do you find it cloying then?
I don't. Yeah. Here's the thing, though. I really, really like the songs that are going for God Bless Mom.
Great song.
I hate saying Mom, but anyway, God bless Mom.
I say Mom,
which only really has about three lines in it. Like, exactly. Really, when you think of it,
it's really Pixies influenced. It's really heavy. It's brilliant. I love it. And there's tons of Colm on violin in it. And it's excellent. Stars Underground, brilliant. Pavement Tune, brilliant. Rent Day Blues, one of my other favourites. Exceptional, you know? And then there's just lots of little ones like Meet Me in the Beaches, Beneath the Beaches, which is was written, on a Wikipedia it says, written for his friend Jeff Buckley. And the Star Star. And there's a couple of songs that I kind of, no, this doesn't do it for me. And it's not because they're not good songs. It's because when the band are going for it, I think they're amazing. But when it's kind of in this album, when it's the kind of Glenn show, and it's the poetic, I'm being a poet, Glenn. And I'm not really slagging him. I don't mean that in a slaggy way. I mean the ones where he's really kind of opening up his heart and kind of, you know, kind of, you know, whispering it to you, kind of. I can't, and it isn't for me. But and so the album is kind of, it's a bit half and half in that way. But half of it, I was like, this is great.
Yeah, you know? I fully agree. Do you think that that's a lyric thing, or just him as a songwriter? Like, because I mean, I kind of find that, I agree with you completely, absolutely. And I don't think it's even a slagging thing. I think it's a case of, I don't like this version of the Frames when this happens. And it does happen maybe kind of half the time. You can feel the spotlight coming out and the lads kind of take a break or whatever, and then it's his turn. But I just kind of find that, like, the stories he's telling, I don't find them that interesting.
Well, the one thing about, and it's interesting, like, I would be someone who's very into lyrics, and I kind of analyse lyrics a bit, just internally. You know, I was looking at the way they were written. Like, the Plague Monkeys lyrics, I think, we'll come to them later, I think they're exceptional.
Yeah.
They're ambitious, they're brave, and they leave an intrigue on the table. So you could write the short story from the lines, you know? Whereas with some Frame songs, there's a thing happening where he's telling you a story, and then later in the song he's shouting the lyrics. And the thing is that the lyrics aren't separated enough. They're not deep. Not that they're not deep enough. They're not intangible enough that they can mean two different things. They're kind of, the lyrics are kind of, they're a little bit more straightforward, you know. They're telling you as opposed to they're telling you something as opposed to building a scene that you build in your head, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. I mean, like, there's a simplicity to some great lines, I think, in songs, and with the simplicity comes the subtext. And I love subtext. I love diving into and getting it wrong. I mean, like, I love, like, writing a 1,000-word album review, and maybe I'm totally off the point, but, like, it's what I got from it. But I mean, like, I look at, like, a song like Hold the Moon by the Waterboys, and that kind of line of, like, I spoke about wings, you just flew. That says, that's,
you love that line.
It's amazing, man. It's a book. There's a book in that line. I mean, like, there's so much you can look at. Whereas with this, I admire the conviction, and he's clearly got the courage of his convictions, but I just, when he goes into that mode, it's not that I'm, like, running to turn off the radio. I'm just kind of like, not really, really, really for me, Glenn. You know,
oh,
like,
just to be clear, I don't think the lyrics are bad.
No, I know, yeah.
At all. I just think that they're, you know, basically there's a huge mean of lyrics. Most lyrics fit into the, that's pretty good, or that's good, or that works, you know. And then every now and again there's a spike, which is an amazing lyric. And, you know, on, of these albums, it was on the Plagues Monkeys album, if you know what I mean. All the rest were good and they worked. And you know something, at a live gig, I imagine they work really well for a Frames gig, like, you know, shouting along to some of it, you know. The Stars of Underground is an absolute belter.
Like excellent song, yeah.
It's like there's some absolute belters here. And
I think you like the album more than your... No, as you're going on, no, you go, this is every
okay,
single
Kieran.
Song is... I actually really like this one and I like that one.
No, but the point is I think that half of the album I really like much more than I thought, and half of the album it's just not for me. And that's a funny thing. I think it's quite...
I like the versatility of it. I think that they do balance it out. It hangs together very well as an album, and I think this the quieter, more reflective moments, like... I'm going to make a confession here that lyrics aren't that as important to me maybe as they are to you two. That if they, as a huge REM fan, early REM, push his glasses up nose, by the way, this is, but I think when I had my heart broken, I was a devotee of REM, and then I got a book of their lyrics and it's utter bollocks for a lot of it. But it didn't stop me from enjoying the songs as much. You know, I kind of would go along like a Dr. Zeus poem that Michael Sipe would go into. So I think I've lost... At that time, anyway. I mean, great lyrics are very important. I'm not denying the great lyricists of our time that they've got a power, but it didn't prevent me. I didn't get to it in that level, maybe. I just would listen to the song as a whole package. And I think, for the most part, most of the songs on this album work. And I think that it's a more complete album than maybe you're giving it a...
Yeah, it feels like there's a really nice contrast with those songs, like the way it kind of comes up and down. And so I know that you're kind of saying when he's like singing in your ear almost, but I think that's quite nice. It's like a little bit of respite from kind of some of the heavier parts in the album. So I did kind of like that.
It's balanced very well, I think, yeah.
Mm. Okay, well, I'm just saying what I think. The other thing about it is that one of the better songs on it, Pavement Tune, is a brilliant song. And I'm a bit frustrated by it because it is... so incredibly similar to Bobby Pulls a Wilson song called For the Love of Cork. And Bobby Pulls a Wilson is the kind of band that I'm sure people are going, who are Bobby Pulls a Wilson? And they have an incredible song that just happens to sound spectrally like a Pavement Tune. Now, I'm not accusing anyone of everything, but it is just mad. And so I went back and listened to the Bobby Pulls a Wilson song, and it's brilliant. So if anyone's interested, go and look it up.
As a fellow new metal kid, Elaine, I know you must appreciate some of the down-tuned bass on this
record. Yeah, it was kind of surprising. And
yeah,
I was not expecting
it?
That at all.
No, it came out of nowhere, and I was like, that sounds gorgeous. Where did that come from?
Which is pretty cool, because I think, obviously, you know, it being their third album or whatever, you can kind of tell that they were quite settled at that point and were happy enough to make whatever music they wanted to make, which is kind of a nice place to be in for a band.
I just think on this album as a whole, personally, and in the context of why we're revisiting these years and looking back at what Irish albums were produced in these years, the Frames, for me, were the band that, at the earliest point, made me pay attention to Irish music, current Irish music, and to go on and actively seek out other singer-songwriters bands because of them. So that's why I kind of hold this one in quite special regard, because, you know, going on to subsequent years, like, in getting into like David Kitt and Bell X1 and Gemma Hayes and that kind of stuff. At the time, I was listening to an awful lot of pop music, hip-hop music, stuff like that, because I didn't necessarily know where to source Irish music or have the money to do so, and it wasn't like you were hearing vast amounts of it on the radio either. So hearing the Frames for the first time totally changed my perspective on Irish music.
Wow.
Okay, that's an admirable sentiment. I will not argue it. Let's have a listen to the Frankenwalters, see what they were up to. Today from Beauty Becomes More Than Life, Ed, tell us all about it.
Full disclosure, I'm from Cork, but this is not informing my
I'm from Cork,
my decision to pick this of the five albums. The Frankenwalters, Beauty Becomes More Than Life, is the third album, and they'd only actually, to my surprise, released three albums in the 90s. They were a big part of my childhood growing up in Cork, of course, and I think to this day one of the great and maybe possibly underrated bands that this country has produced. Again, I'm trying not to display my bias, but I genuinely think they're a wonderful, great, great band. So they had Trains, Boats and Planes with their debut album. That's that set the scene for the band as a kind of slightly almost cartoonish presence. You know, Paul with the hair, and they were on Top of the Pops after all, and This Is Not a Song. And they had a certain, they kind of fitted into the kind of Britpop, like, again, to go back to the kind of slightly comic presence. And I think then people will say Grand Parade is their favourite Frank and Walter's record, but similar enough maybe to what we just discussed there with the Frames. At the end of the 90s, things hadn't quite taken off for them. Hadn't really maybe quite worked even with the record labels. They had Edwin Collins on board, of course. And I think they found themselves in New York at one stage, and I think they just said, fuck this. And they threw off the shackles here. And this is almost an album about, it's a lot of love songs here, a lot of bitterness, a lot of anger. Not maybe traits or adjectives you'd associate with the Franco Walters. When you say Franco Walters, you're supposed to have a smile on your face and you're supposed to bop your head side to side, and it's all very summery. But Paul and Ashley and the boys here have, I think, to produce some very dark, angry and very bitter songs, which is another thing. Again, as I mentioned earlier, sometimes some of the best albums from bands and singers come out of a place of frustration and anger. And I'd find that the case here with the Franks, that some of the stuff, the lyrics on here, and I think, you know, while Paul mightn't have the most technically proficient voice, he really, not the best singer, but he has what most singers don't have. He's, you know, he's got sincerity, and he means every word he sings. And I think that, and the lyrics here, he's obviously written himself. They're in a dark place here. And I think they've just, again, they've thrown off the coat that they'd woven themselves from the previous couple of albums, and the expectation of the Franks being a certain way. And they would just hold themselves up for a few months and went, let's just experiment. This could be the end of things for us. I think they were kind of at the stage where they're on the verge of giving up. And I think that this is the album, which thankfully isn't their swan song, but they were going to go out with a bang. And to my mind, they really did, yeah.
I mean, we've talked with Frank Walters before on the show, and as you say, they're kind of happy-go-lucky. At least that's the go-to.
Mm.
You know, you picture the kind of uniform that they wear and everything.
Of course, so, yeah, yeah.
I mean, hearing this for the first time, where you kind of, you mentioned the heartbreak that you had with R.E.M. when you read the lyrics. I mean, like, this is such a sea change. So, were you,
yeah, exactly. I think I was surprised. I remember it coming out at the time. I was 23 at the time. I just started working Today FM, so I was very busy, and I just found out my girlfriend was pregnant that year as well. So that year was kind of tattooed in my brain for many reasons, two life-changing moments. And I remember listening to this album quite a lot of the time, and I hadn't gone back to it since. So again, very grateful for this opportunity to go back. And it, similar to the Frames, it's a perfectly pitched and curated album from one to, I think there's 12 tracks on the album. Is there more than 12?
No, I was going to say perfectly pitched. I'm going to fight you on that.
Okay. Oh, sorry, I thought I'd made a mistake. Factually.
Oh, no.
And take two. So of the 12 tracks on the album, I think they're all, you know, lined up beautifully. And I think that it kind of shows the Franks at their best, angriest and darkest. I think the opening track, Plenty of Times, again, is on surer footing. It's kind of a happy-go-lucky, jaunty tune. But they get quite experimental. The track 7:30 is essentially a dance track, you know, and it's a lot of influence here from U2, I think, or vice versa. I don't know which way it went at that time, but you could hear echoes of Lemon in here and things like that. So it's great to see them kind of branching out a little bit from their kind of slightly narrow fur that they'd built for themselves over the previous 8 years. But I could hear a lot of the Smiths, of course, people, as we were mentioning as well, that I suppose that time we said goodnight is Paul had just gone through a breakup in a relationship. And this is his maybe revenge, as it were. And it's not something you would, again, associate with the Franks, having this kind of very bitter and bittersweet side to them. And it really, really works very, very well. There's a touch of Whipping Boy off some of this record as well, I think.
I was wondering, was there a breakup just happened beforehand?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of stuff about, you see, he's a very sensitive lyricist. He often writes quite directly, lyrically. And the thing about direct lyrics is sometimes they can just pass you by because they are just, you're just saying a thing. I feel sad and I hope that I don't feel sad tomorrow, you know, whatever. If it's just something like that, it kind of just doesn't catch you. But the other thing, if they're well written direct lyrics, sometimes something that you've heard before catches on you in a way that hadn't before. And the song Today says, I think that, I'm not going to get the lyric right, but it's something like, I hope that I will always love you, you know. I hope that I'll always be in love with you.
Yeah.
And I thought, I was thinking that he's not saying hope that we're always in love. He's saying that I hope that I always feel that I am in love. You know what I mean? And I was thinking that's a different way of saying something that's been said a lot.
I think that song is about their career.
Okay.
And I this is me again, spitballing with no information from the band at all or anything like that, but having listened to the lyrics over and over again, they have another great line that, and it's not particularly you know, powerful in this when you see it written down on page, but when Paul sings, it's never coming back again, it's never going to be the same. And he sings it with such heartbreaking emotion. And I think, again, just see where they were positioned in their career and emotionally at the time, I think you could say, if you wanted to drill down into it, for want of a better expression, that they're talking about their music career here, that if you listen to them with those ears on, I think it's a love song to the music that they produced and how things didn't work out. And he sings it beautifully, and that's my favourite song on the record by a country man.
No one
could write a chorus like the Frank Walters. Like, they build up to a chorus and it just kind of, you can feel it coming.
Yeah, they're very good at that, yeah.
You know, and it's like you've dropped the pill and you can just feel it coming. It's going to, any minute now, and next thing, it just soars. They're one of the best chorus writers I've heard in Irish music, and it's writ large here again. And today especially, I think, is probably the best song. And then you've got, what's the one? Oh, Castaway. I liked Castaway as well. It's kind of pre-Beirut.
That was a slightly different one on the album, and that kind of four-bar, the way the changes are, is quite classic. Again, kind of direct, and I don't know if that works as well as some, like, for example, they have the pop stuff, which is, you know, Plenty Times, which is the opening track, and they have Something Happened to Me, obviously.
With that wah-wah guitar at the beginning.
Yeah, so it's all, like, they have that all going, and then it sounds, a lot of the rest of the album sounds like the band kind of trying to develop or going for just doing things differently, you know, and the song Stop and the song Until the End and the song 7:30 are all very, you know, different sounds for them, you know, it feels like, it, like you said, thrown off the shackles. It feels like they're going for it. It doesn't always work. I wouldn't be.
Well, I mean,
the middle of the album isn't.
Let me know. Again, I've heard the album maybe 8-9 times last week, and I still can't. It hasn't stuck with me at all. So, I mean, there is some filler in here.
Yeah, that's the only thing. The only thing is that there's a little bit of filler, and as a result, I think it affects. There's some great songs in this. Absolutely, I totally agree. That song Today is just exceptional. I think, you know, Something Happened to Me is really, really good as well, but they stand out a lot. You know, there's a couple of these albums, again, a little bit of filler on them, but this one, you know, there's that song 7:30, and you said it was like a dance song. I was like, you know, it sounded like it was a song maybe that wasn't working, and they just,
it's a little indulgent.
The start, just as the album is kind of going, I think it's a four track or something, it's like, already I'm switched off from that, you know. And then you get into the middle of the album and it has Today and Something Happened to Me and The Time We Say Goodnight, and you know, that's just exceptional, you know. And like, if I would just jink it around a little bit, but I think it's a really strong album. I agree with you, yeah.
And it finishes beautifully with Until the End, and again, to maybe bolster my own half-baked take on the album being an album about themselves and their career. You know, it's a farewell track, not just to the album, I think, but it's almost as if you can hear them saying, again, it's positioned as a relationship, you're saying goodbye to your girlfriend, but I kind of feel that it's them saying, that's it, lads, you know. And that, for me, if I'd heard it at the time, which I did, and I didn't pick up on it, because I'm stupid, but I think that was them going, as if it fades, literally fades towards the end, and you can see the three of them, or four of them, just kind of walking away, and almost brings a tear to my eye. But I just loved it. I think it hangs together very well, and to me, it's their best album.
To pick up on your subtext, though, and to dive right in, because I said I do love to do that. I mean, is it a case of, are they a band that are tagged with the dreaded underrated?
I think they're beloved,
because that usually translates to, you know, never played the big shows.
No, I think there's an awful thing they have in England is like national treasure. We don't have national treasures here, but there's a certain kind of condescension that goes on with the Franks. That,
yeah, I think there is.
They're beloved, and they're the kind of band you kind of hook under your armpit and ruffle their heads and go, ah, they're likable, you know. But I think there's more to them than that, and I think what they do is deceptively clever. And like, even After All or some of their bigger hits, they're proper good indie pop songs, and that's the hardest thing, is to get a good melody into a song. And they'll always, even at their darker, more rockier moments on this album, not their genius, but their greatness to me, is they'll still weave in the old Grey Whistle Test in the chorus, and you can hum it. And that to me is a sign of a good band. I'm that guy, I'm afraid. I have to.
It has to be your melody is the king. But
I just have to be able to hear it and hum it.
It's the most important thing. Yeah. Like, I mean, you can have an incredible lyrics, but if the melody in the song is good, you're not going to like it.
Yeah,
but you can have an amazing melody and average lyrics, and the song can be amazing.
They can have this way of even just weaving it with one thread through the song, and you go, I can hear it. And even if they're rocking out, or as you say, experimenting, and like 7:30 here, there's somehow, even in the ether, there's a song there. I can hear it.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to hear the song.
Yeah. I know in that particular track, maybe not a good example, but
that impression of the Frank Wallace that Dave mentioned is one that I certainly had. And I've never actually made a real effort to kind of get to know them, I guess.
Of course, yeah.
Whereas from our list of five, this would be the album that I would actually take away and actually want to really listen to a lot. Because it really took me by surprise. I had this impression of them, which made me never actively want to listen to their albums in full as such. But this one was a really, really pleasant surprise for me.
I loved it. And of all the five, not just because I chose it, but I think the Frames and this are ones I'm going to be throwing on in the care. It's a good driving album because it gets you from A to B. It's kind of a little journey in itself. But again, it's great for them. I think brave move from them, I think, to kind of dispel that. They're almost like the Irish Monkeys. They kind of have this kind of, again, to go back to it, a cartoonish presence, and people don't take them that seriously, I think, over the years. And
that's the thing. I mean, like, I think anytime we talk about them on the show, Keir, we always tend to go be like, oh, they're so versatile. And I can only imagine them listening to the show and being like, where the fuck were you? Like, back when we needed you.
I know.
I was listening to Limp Bizkit, guys. I'm sorry. Like, you know, it's like.
It's your fault.
Ah, it is. It's entirely my fault. But up next, an album that's Kieran's fault this week. This is The Prayer Boat. Have a listen. Here's my new beginner. That's off Police Chanel. I'm sure I pronounced it wrong, but what can you do? That was Saved. Keir?
This is Police Chanel, I think, by The Prayer Boat, which is two brothers, Emma Tinley and Patrick Tinley. And it's a four-piece, but they seem to move around the lineup. And it had a very sad line in Wikipedia. It says, the band do not see each other anymore.
I saw that.
I was like, why did you put that in? who fact-checked that?
Apart from the brothers, obviously, or something like that.
Yeah, it's random, yeah.
At funerals and weddings.
Even then?
But like, you know what I mean? It's not like, you know, who's the guy from Wikipedia who has to go and fact-check this? Must have been really sad, you know, calling around to their houses, checking their phone history.
You guys!
But I think it's their second album. It was released, their first album was released in 1991, Oceanic Feeling.
What a name, by the way.
Oceanic Feeling. Well, if you
it's
like
as
potential.
As 90s as it gets.
But yeah, so that was 91. And I think from what I could read through various interviews and sites and stuff, they spent a bit of time kind of selling the band a little bit. I think there was a lot of ambition there for what they were doing. They released a lot of EPs in the meantime. And a lot of this album came out around 1995. 1996, two tracks came out in the Dark Green EP. I think there was a Saved single as well, and then there was a mini album release, I think, two years before. So there was lots of the songs that existed. They were kind of, I don't know, I think they'd gone to the States and tried, I think it seems like Emmett Tinley went on his own to the States and played around New York and South West and stuff like that, and to try and get interest up. And that sounds like a tough thing. But the album, anyway, he came back re-energized, and this album was recorded and released in 1999. I think it's really warm. I think it's really well crafted. You can hear the craft throughout it. I think it's emotional. I think it's honest. And I think in a strange way, I put this album on and I just, whatever it was about it, I just loved it. It's like the whole album has an atmosphere, and I love albums that do that. And the entire thing, I just, from the start, I was really, really into it. As I say, recorded again, like 95, 96, a lot of it. And there is definitely an influence of the Bends, I think. I think there's an influence of Jeff Buckley. And I think you can trace a line from it to kind of Damien Rice as well, that kind of thing. And the singer-songwriter thing that kind of blighted the land in the early 2000s. But yeah, it's an exceptional album. The title track Police Chanel, the song Dark Green, and there's a song called It Hurts to Lose You, and I think it's the best album on the list. I think it's the best album of the year, and I think it's one of my favourite discoveries that I've made musically in the last... What are you laughing at?
That's the show, guys. Thanks for coming.
That's a wrap.
I'm slightly joking, but I think I was really, really delighted. You know, the reason that, like, you know, we're doing the show is to discover stuff, I think, and I really loved it. I put it on, and it just accompanied me for the last kind of 2 weeks, and I love it.
It accompanied me today while I was cleaning my kitchen, giving it a real deep scrub. And
people
I have to
clean their kitchen.
You have to clean your kitchen. Like, it's tough. It's tough work.
You have to clean your kitchen.
I put the elbow grease in, and I did. And this was accompanying me in the background, and I have to say, it was a great companion to such hard, intensive labor. Because it really was. The word I was going to use, I said off mic before the show, there was a word I was going to use to describe this record, and we were kind of saying, is it a negative word? I think it is, but I don't mean it in a negative way, but the word earnest, which you actually used earlier.
Oh, no.
About something else.
I stepped on your earnest.
That's okay. That's fine. Like, stepping on the earnest, I like it. But yeah, I was like, this is a fucking earnest record, isn't it? Jesus.
This is an earnest record.
This guy's got a lot to share. But I
like
that.
It didn't grate on me. That,
no, it didn't grate on me either.
Things being overly earnest... usually, I know, as Ed mentioned, the Irish thing, but this didn't. I believed every word. I think he's got an exceptional voice.
Well, the Irish Independent quoted, described him as possesses a range that would make opera singers weep. I bet you love that, didn't he? That's how you read that, and he was like, yeah, that's it. Now, you mentioned, did you mention Jeff Buckley?
I think there's
compared to Jeff Buckley, Thom Yorke, Chris Martin, Fran Healy of Travis, like as you say, it's that kind of turn of the century kind of, you know, male singer songwriter.
That's when the album was being reviewed.
Oh, of course, yeah, like, you can't help.
So they were the touchstones.
It's one of those journalism things. I apologize.
Full disclosure: I liked the first Travis album.
What was the first Travis album? Was that the one with All I Want to Do?
The Invisible Band or something, whatever it was called. I can't remember. I liked early Travis. I want to get that off my chest. I've been waiting 20 years.
The Invisible Band was a third album with Nigel Godrich, and that's a great album.
Turn's a really good song.
Turn's a really good song.
It's a great song.
Some beautiful tunes. Anyway, sorry.
Still going, I believe.
I digress. I think the Prayer Boat, for me, were always spoken about in hushed, reverential corners. They were almost like a mythical band. I remember the time when the Frames were kind of like this beloved monster kind of taking up everyone's attention and affection, that people would speak about them. Yeah, but it's the Prayer Boat. And I can see why. Now, I absolutely loved it. It's all Tinley's voice. It is beautiful, and the production really brings it to the fore. Without, as I think, foregoing, there's a lot of 12 strings. There's a lot of orchestration on this, and it all balances and works beautifully together. There's, like, I love Dead Flowers. It's probably my favorite track. Saved is probably the best.
Probably
song
the hit is probably Saved, I suppose.
As such, yeah.
But there's a bonus track after In My Arms, which is falsetto, and it's gorgeous. It's very short. It's like two minutes long, and it's a gorgeous little song. I think it's an adaptation of a song that was released again in kind of 95 or whatever. But I liked it, and I, you know, sometimes when I'm doing this, I have it on in the house and I'm just pottering around, or I'm out for a walk, or I'm doing whatever. But when I have it on in the house, sometimes, you know, my wife will come in and go, turn that shite off. But whatever it is, I'm trying to... Well, she doesn't say turn. She's very nice. But she might kind of go, that's a little bit loud. And I'll go, oh, sorry. But she came in and she was like,
turn that up.
This is excellent.
Yeah.
Crank it.
You know, and she was like, I feel like I need to clean
it. This album made some babies back in 99. You just know that it provided a soundtrack to many of the smooch sessions. And I don't mean to demean it by saying that, but it is a very lush... and it's very heartbreaking in parts, but I just love the production on this. And again, to go back to his voices.
It is gorgeously engineered. Yeah, it's beautiful to listen to. I think Soon the Stars Will Steer Me is a really great one as well.
I think one thing about this is, of all the versions that came after it and before it of earnest singer-songwriter, I know this is a band, but singer-songwriter, you know, that style, I think this is one of the best representations of it. I don't find myself liking a lot of this kind of music, but I really like this, and I guess I was surprised by it. I think if someone described what the album is like, I would go, oh, not listen to that.
That's the thing, and I mean, like, Elaine, not to put you on the spot or anything, but your recent EP, The Colour of the Night, we talked about it on No Encore before, it's excellent, but a lot of it is very confessional, and it's, you know, it's you kind of, like, really stepping up and putting yourself out there. And I wonder, do I, as a journalist, like, just being, like, do I take it for granted, like, when someone kind of really commits and kind of puts himself out there as he does with this record? I mean, like, I guess it's probably a lot more difficult for a musician to actually release this kind of stuff. than it is for me to just go, ah, it's a bit emotional, you know? I've often kind of
wondered.
I think
so, but then you kind of have a stronger connection to the music, which is pretty amazing for yourself as well, I guess. Like, I really like this album as well. I think more than all of the other albums that I listened to, it kind of drew me in straight away, which I just thought that his voice is just gorgeous. It kind of reminded me of Weak of Corners almost.
Yeah,
it reminded me a little bit of Weak of Corners, yeah.
Yeah, but I think Police Chanel, from, if I'm probably saying that completely wrong,
nobody knows.
We decided.
Honestly.
Was probably my favourite track on that. I really liked it.
I got a bit of James, a bit of Tim Booth in there as well. That is the James lead singer, isn't it?
Tim Booth, yeah.
Because I like me some James, and there was some of the tracks there I think they were kind of veering towards that, which is never a bad thing. I'm always very aware of going,
yeah,
it sounds a bit, I know, I think that it's maybe doing it a disservice, but like Elaine says, I think it's aged very well. It hasn't aged at all, actually. I think
it has aged really well as well. And
could have been released last year.
Sometimes when you look back on an album, I think the places where it ages are the things that they're doing that aren't natural, if you know what I mean. It's like what they're trying to do to fit into zeitgeist, or what they're trying to do to add a weird sound in. The stuff that lasts is the stuff where you're most honest and most being yourself. And so then I would assume, because it hasn't aged, it's them being at their most honest and being their most themselves. People online, the little sprites who write things.
Jesus, where are you going with this?
Dave is one such sprite, I believe.
Yeah. No, but they say that, you know, this is them at their peak of their powers. And it just feels like, it's a great album. And it's funny, it was the track listing was readjusted for the 10-year anniversary in 2009. And I was kind of like...
He was doing Kanye West before Kanye West did Kanye West?
Yeah, but I was kind of like, you know, I didn't think it worked as well because it made it quite front-loaded. And I was thinking just the way it was great, you know? I just don't... The rejigging of things to put the singles up the top. No, I just... The way... The version that's on online for the 1999 version is excellent.
I mean, is there an element we've had when Jen Gannon was on the show before? We talked about Damien Rice, I think it was, and she was kind of saying, like, after we were all kind of reverential about it, like the lads in the room were like, "Oh, he really captures the emotions." She was like, "Give me a fucking break." Like, is there an element of this guy's going too far? Like, what do you think, Elaine?
My impression of this album was this was probably the one I had the least amount of time with because, as you said, it was Kieran's one before. It wasn't on my original list, but I could have heard tracks off this album, and if you had told me that they were off the soundtrack to Dawson's Creek or some late 90s movie,
Dawson's Creek.
I would have just said, okay, cool, yeah. I'm not saying that I don't like it. It just, it could have been from anywhere. That was my initial take on it, but
so you're,
disclaimer.
Sorry, is it a generic thing that you're thinking?
Yes. Okay. Not that I didn't like it. I have not, and that's the disclaimer, I haven't spent that much time with it.
He's actually crying.
And I don't want to make you cry, but that was kind of, you know.
I think that the one thing that I did think about this album was that it's not breaking any, you know, this isn't OK Computer. This isn't like going to be written about how it is very thickly kind of laced with the DNA of all that kind of beautiful, emotional, warm, you know, that kind of thing. It is that. It's just a good version of it, I think. And I think you're absolutely right. I think there are a lot of things that would sound like it. I was just on the train on the way in, just flicking through Spotify, and it kept bringing me to Delamitri tracks. And I was like, fucking Delamitri, you know? But like, the fact that anyone could think that they sound like that shows that maybe there is, I suppose, an openness to the sound, you know? You could take the vocalist out maybe and then put another vocalist in, and there, maybe you could put, you know, a lot of different vocalists
in. Then again, Spotify algorithms are ridiculous at times. Yeah, like, well, you like listening to this record, so why don't you listen to this? Like, really? Like, they're not even from the same, like, not even the same league.
You're like Nine Inch Nails?
Yeah. Go listen to Britney Spears, which, you know, is also good. But I just wanted to bring you down a little bit here. I felt you were like kind of in the clouds a little bit there. So thanks, Elaine. Appreciate that. And we'll move on.
Well played.
To our next to our next record. This is The Four of Us, and this is from Classified Personal. Maybe I like your style, but you're so things you care the most about.
that's Volatile. And is it a volatile album, Elaine?
It's certainly not a volatile album. You can't really get more easy listening than this album, I would say. I saw this on the original list and I decided not to go for albums that I already knew, but instead ones that I didn't know at all, or indeed from bands that I would perceive to be, to me, one-hit wonders. The only Four of Us song that I knew was, of course, Mary. And so I decided to check out this album and see what I made of it. And I actually ended up really enjoying it. Like, it's very laid back. It's heavily acoustic. One thing I really like in vocally is when someone sings in their native tone.
Yeah,
you can hear an accent shining through. Yeah. Like, say, one of my favorite vocalists is Irish vocalist is Duke Special. Because he sings in his accent.
Yeah, it's terrific.
And there is an element of this from the Four of Us hailing from County Down. And I suppose what grabbed me about this album was, again, much like the Frank Walters, I had a perception of a band that I'd never actually properly listened to. And because I wasn't actively listening to them at the time, like, I was 14 when this album came out, I was probably still rejoicing at Man United winning the Champions League in between playing Metal Gear Solid. Like, I wasn't a cool kid. Like, I wasn't a cool teenager. So it was just really nice to revisit it in that way and just listen to a band that I literally knew nothing about. And then looking through their, through their back catalogue further back, and, you know, how they had been signed to a major label and how that had fallen through. And then it was a good 6 or 7 years before this was released then in 99 that they'd had quite big success. Like, they'd broken the UK charts and stuff like that. So this was obviously their recenter piece. And you know, it's a very laid back listen. It's the kind of thing you could throw on a Sunday morning whilst reading the paper and having a coffee and just happily have it sit there in the background. But yeah, that was my take on it.
I think that's fair. And I mean, like, I mean, growing up in Drogheda, like, kind of seeing posters for bands that would occasionally come to town, it seemed like the Four of Us were in Drogheda every week. I'm sure they weren't. People just weren't taking down the posters. But I had this thing of, like, knowing what they look like, knowing their name, knowing something about them, but not quite ever really connecting with it. And then I found myself, when I did, I was like, well, this is just kind of easy listening. And I don't mean that in, like, a really disparaging way, but, like, I always struggle with that style of music, that kind of, you know, whether it's, not that they're direct comparisons, but, like, you know, Norah Jones, Katie Melua, that kind of thing, where you're like, how could anybody ever really get terribly passionate about this? I mean, I know that a lot of people just want something to listen to that isn't too challenging. Like, not the vast majority, of course, but, like, some people just want that kind of thing, and that's cool. There's something for everybody. But, like, I mean, I didn't struggle with this record, because you couldn't struggle with this record. It is enjoyable. It is pleasant. But I struggle with the idea of, not quite a lack of ambition or imagination, but is there a lack of ambition or imagination here with this band? I mean, like, especially with the time period, as you say, like, you know, like, coming from, you know, the highs and then crashing a little bit and kind of picking themselves back up, taking time to do it, and then the end result is a good album?
Well, I don't think that's actually... It's actually an interesting story. You know, the Four of Us, obviously, they very big with Mary and all the rest. And so they got... I think they got dropped in, I think, 94. And they went to record a rock album, like a really, you know, different sound, an album called Amplifier. They spent 3 years recording it and writing it. They released two singles for it. And in 97, they scrapped it. And, like, that was where the album was supposed to be, and then that didn't exist. So then they went back, started completely from scratch, and they have made a conscious decision here, I think, to do something that isn't that. He said in an interview, I don't want to see another electric... I don't want to see another distorted guitar, you know, for years or whatever. And they came out and I think they deliberately wrote a more gentle, a more laid back acoustic album. You know, they were down to a three piece here, the Murphy brothers, Brennan and Declan, and with Peter McKinney on drums. So there was a lineup change as well. And I think you can hear that they just brought it sort of back to basics, I think. You know, like, this is 14 tracks. I mean, like,
it could have been 11, I think.
Could have been 9, you know. And it's just that thing of, like, being hard on yourself, you know, about, I don't know. It's sometimes, it's like, I just want them to be the best version of themselves. And I feel like that would be really, really good. The best of the Four of Us, I assume, is an excellent album. But this just is it's just a little bit too much filler for me.
There is. I agree on the track listing thing. Like, it is 14 songs long. It could have easily been 10 or 11. Say, right, keep those three for B-sides of the singles. And it would have felt like a tighter album. Yeah, a tighter album.
They have a line here that goes, former punk with young son will reply to everyone. And you're going, ah, I can see that man now. you know, he's in a man of a certain age, maybe single father, used to be a punk, and he's lonely. And that's just maybe 1, 2, 3, 9 words. And like, I think they, when they're on form in that regard, like adventurous divorcee, a youthful of 43, that you're going, oh, you know, that they're telling stories there. And I think that, again, as Elaine was saying, that it's slightly bloated. And the tempo of the album really doesn't kick into maybe third gear enough for it to be more interesting, any more interesting. But again, it is so listenable. And
it is.
You have to be careful with easy listening, that it's a pejorative. But it's hard to do easy listening and to still engage you and find it.
But the only thing about easy listening is it's often passive listening. So it just doesn't go in. It doesn't hook onto you.
There's room for that, though, I think.
No, there is absolutely room for that. But I still think that it is, you can still say that it's, I was talking about this before. Michael Maloney was on another show, and he's like, "What's wrong? Oh, that's terrible. He wrote a song that everyone kind of likes. Oh no, you know." But I think that's, and while that is true, that is kind of a silly thing to be kind of saying. Why did you write this song? I think that they, at their best, I think they're excellent. But for me, there's a lot of this which is just good, you know, the kind of way.
We talked about that Van Morrison record on that episode, and I was kind of saying, I was kind of saying what you're saying now, and you're like, Dave, you're cop on. You're like you're just saying like, yeah, it's grand, and like you're like that's not good enough. So, and I wonder, like, you know, is it disheartening that they had this new path, and then they were like, no, fuck it, no, don't do that. Let's just go back to our comfort zone. Like, I don't know if them trying to be Muse circa 99, a la maybe JJ72, would have worked.
Well, Dan Hegarty on 2FM says that the album that they didn't release is excellent. Okay. The Amplified album. So we don't know.
That's so frustrating, though.
It is frustrating, like, yeah. And he played some of the tracks on a show. I found it online. The links didn't work, unfortunately, because they've obviously been taken down. But he had put up, you know, I think maybe 5 years ago, there was a show where he had played songs from that album, you know. And I think that's kind of... Is it better that it exists in my head as this amazing album that blows everyone's minds and that I don't get to hear it?
Great last Irish album.
Yeah, exactly. But like, look, I mean, the four of us are like, they have an exceptional way with melody. They obviously know how to write a tune. It's just that this has just got too much filler on it as an album, which is a weird thing to say because the best songs are great. Like, as you said, Ed, and as I say, the opening, the lyrics in the opening song, One More Shot, are brilliant. They're really evocative. They're excellent. When they work, they work. But a lot of times it feels a little bit... Like they could do, you could, you know, they could ramp it up a notch and go a bit weirder, go a bit more interesting, and it would have been, just the ones that work, put them on, you know?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect summary. Like, I mean, like, I find that with whether it's a film or whether it's a TV show or an album, coming away from it kind of being in the middle is always the worst place to be. Like, if something is going to be spectacularly terrible, you know, at least you can talk about it and, you know, kind of riff off it and even kind of, you know, without completely destroying everyone involved, it can be like, well, this was just such a disaster. Like it's fascinating. And with something that's phenomenal or even very, very good, you're like, oh, cool. Well, you get those spikes somewhere in the middle. I mean, you're just kind of like...
It is a bit safe, I think, is the...
Yeah, it really is.
Safe is a good word. Why didn't I use that word 5 minutes ago?
You would have saved us a lot of time.
We'll edit it down to just you saying safe.
Safe, mate.
It sounds like Ed Smith there briefly.
I actually really like this one, but I did just think that it was too long. But I wonder if that's just like a kind of a more old school album thing where, you know, you were kind of putting your whole thing into doing an album and making a really impressive work of art or whatever, and maybe that you felt that you had to put 14 songs on your album. Like, I don't think that exists anymore in the same way.
Well, that art form, I think, of bookending an album long before I make that call, it's the final song on this album, and it finishes with a lovely kind of flourish. I'm making a gesture here you can't see, but I'm on a stage, I'm in a circus or something. Anyway, but I'm just doing the kind of end of show gesture.
Get down off the
chair.
And
it kind of finishes in a kind of a lovely... elegant way. I'm going, you can just almost hear the curtains just closing and the album is over. And that, again, it's the same with the Franks. They finish with a lovely fade out and that's it. And that maybe art form has been lost.
I think so, yeah.
Well, people can't listen to albums anymore. The art of listening to the album and making them has been eroded to the point of
I think very commercial albums are just like processions of singles now. I mean, one of the big things they were talking about, that Spotify has changed. They said that it hasn't actually changed. People still release albums, you know, they still release content or whatever, you know, they're calling it now. But one of the big things is that there's less filler and there's less intros and the songs are shorter. And I think, you know... There was a thing that happened when, you know, CDs became available or whatever, where suddenly you could have, you know, 90 minutes of music or whatever. So people started to, you know, bloat their albums out, because you could have a 15-minute thing at the end, whatever. But yeah, and that's funny as well. A lot of these albums have hidden tracks. I was just thinking, and hidden tracks obviously don't exist anymore either. You know,
Some people are still doing it, even though it makes no sense to do it. Like, it's like, yeah, I'll just skip. There we go.
Yeah.
6 minutes of silence to get to this gem. No, I forgot to turn off my CD. Okay, well, look, let's get to our last album. You mentioned them. This is the Plague Monkeys. The album is The Sunburn Index, and this song is called The Bomb Circle. So much easier to talk, so much harder to, such a lack of thought and values too. So that's the Plague Monkeys. We had Carole Keogh on the show before. Her vocals tend to be kind of one of the most highlighted things when you go over old reviews of this band. I read the Hot Press review of this, actually, and the score given by Peter Murphy in an excellent review. He gave it 9 out of 12. And I want to say that wasn't the website like that I archived this getting it wrong, and it was just kind of weird Hot Press glitch.
They used to have the two dice.
That's how
they used to mark it out of. They'd throw two dice and that would be the... rating out of 12.
That's incredible. Like, when I worked there, that didn't happen. That should have been happening.
So they let dice decide.
No.
I loved it.
Snake Eyes.
Two. But I liked it, and that's the important thing. What I really like about this record, though, is it's kind of smart alecky. Like, it has this kind of ability to be kind of, you know, kind of elliptical here and there, but also just very kind of coarse in a weird way without being... without ever straying into like vulgar pretension. I mean, like, it opens up and you've got like that song Last Bus. It's an intro, and again it goes back to what you're saying, Ed, where like we don't really do intros anymore, we don't really do outros anymore, and I think it's a very effective way to start it because it takes you in to what they're all about. The Bomb Circle, though, which I played there, like, is the one that I quite like. I might like this one the most because it's deceptively simple and almost knowingly duplicitous at the same time, because it has this weird thing going on where like it refers to what Americans call closure, that line, and that to me, like, on the surface is like, you know, like, let's mock this overly emotive culture. Whereas if you kind of like dig a little bit deeper, and not even that much deeper, but if you look at it, it kind of reflects the Irishness of, you know, not being able to tap into our own emotions, even at the turn of the millennium. And I think it's a good commentary, I think, like, on both of those kind of stretches. And I don't think that I think if the judgment is being cast there, it's not being cast on the Americans, it's being cast on us for being kind of just beholden to this kind of Irish stereotype of, you know, being great to hang out with, but we bottle up our emotions type thing. And again, I'm really impressed when a song can do that with just one line, like, you know, like, and the way that she sings it as well is very, very good. Her presence on this record I find quite interesting because at certain points she's at the forefront and she's guiding everything, but then there are other times when she kind of almost registers as like a passenger, but not in a passive way, and you can kind of choose when to tune into her and when to kind of zone out, and it's a compliment to the songs. I mean, even that song The Bomb Circle has this gorgeously just like simple arrangement, like it's marching drums, it's glockenspiel touches, and it kind of, you know, you get a little bit of kind of like, you know, I guess guitar or synth lines just kind of coming in to kind of bed it down. Like, it's never an album that goes too far, I think, in terms of its production. I will agree with what you said earlier, like, there's times when it feels a little bit padded, but like at times I was kind of thinking about shoegaze records. I was thinking about, like, even not quite the level, of course, of My Bloody Valentine, but not too far off. I like that they don't want to be boxed in. And again, to refer back to that review, Peter Murphy, who obviously loved the record, his problem with it, though, was that he felt that there was no singles.
Oh, no, I think it's not that there's no singles.
I didn't want singles on this.
Ignore the word singles.
Radio songs.
Ignore the word radio songs. Okay. It's a concise feature track, you know? A track which you say... I think that is missing a little
bit. A hit? Is that the word?
No, I don't mean a hit, but okay. I don't mean anything to do with that. What I mean is like the song, for me, if I'm like, oh, I'm going to play you a song, you know, in that way, and if, you know, like my friend, I call over to my friend Kevin's house, and he sits there and goes, okay, listen to this, puts on, you know, whatever, and I go, oh, that's pretty good, you know, whatever. That thing of doing that, there isn't a song here, because all of them are like, you would need to do that consecutive for 20 minutes for the song to kind of go into their heads. They're all sleepers. Every song in this album is gorgeous. I think it's really, really good. I think they're all growers. They're all sleepers. They're all, for want of a better phrase, they're the ones that kind of burrow into you a little bit.
Yeah.
Totally. It's brilliant. But as a result, there isn't an there's a lack of immediacy at times, and so that can be a little bit, it can be a bit nebulous. It takes a little while to get there.
Is that only a problem though if you're looking at it from, say, like a commercial point of view? If you're like, why aren't this band bigger? That's the reason. But like, I think if you were someone who was into the band and also into the idea of the album being the album, particularly around that time when the album was the album for a lot of people, it was like either you make tapes off the radio that you listen to or you buy albums. So I kind of feel like in that regard, it is rewarding and challenging. I mean, granted now, especially when you're kind of up against it, even as you're saying earlier on, Ed, I know that feeling of being like, there's just so much music and I can't really kind of parse a lot of it. I like that this record made me do that. It actually made me stop listening to what I was listening to. It made me stop watching Glastonbury at the weekend when I was listening to it. And I was like, no, I want to focus on this because I know that this needs to be unlocked and unpacked. And
I agree.
That can't be a fault of the band though, or the record. That's a fault of where we are in 2017. Versus where we would have been in 1999 and what we were doing.
I would disagree to a large extent. I think this album, of all the five, suffers from the worst filler-to-killer ratio.
Really?
And I think there isn't as much to unpack as you say. It's lovely to listen to. And I mean, the real star of the show here is Carol's voice. Mm-hmm. And the tracks in which he is maybe more towards the background on it are the worser. Of the tracks, I mean, she has such a beautiful voice, and when they focus on her voice, they're the strongest songs. I think the tracks, there's Doppler Effect and Over. I think they sound like the soundtrack to a terrible student film, and I think
so. You didn't like those ones?
I didn't. But I mean, there is some beautiful. It's a very lovely shimmer off this album. It's maybe leading on from the title of it that there's this very summery. Reminded me of Harriet Wheeler of the Sundays a lot. The Sundays are, to my mind, a better band than
Kirsty MacColl. There's a lot of
the Plague Monkeys, but I mean, there's a lot going on here. I think it's spread a bit thin over the entire album, but there is at least three or maybe four very lovely songs. I don't quite get I wouldn't be able to drill down as deep as you have there into it and get much more of it than what you have. But I hate to use the word pleasant, but it was really lovely. and if I was doing up a playlist for kind of a summer chill out, you know, drive or, having a few friends over, and I wanted something there to kind of soundtrack the kind of summery vibes and bring us, I'm not saying it's all happy-go-lucky or anything like that, but I think her voice really is the star of the show, and when they kind of sideline her slightly, the album just... I go a bit tone deaf for it then.
How do you feel about like the kind of the two-part track, like Polar Magnets parts 1 and 2? I got a real kind of like Granddaddy meets John Hopkins thing off there.
Yeah,
is more of an atmospheric ambient.
Maybe
track.
There's a bit more ambition there than I'm allowing. But I listened to it, I think it was twice last night, and again of the five, I think there's maybe more filler than I found. There was a consistency in the other albums.
But I think that is it. I think if you have to work at it. Like, I had to listen to this album a lot for it to feel like I could get it. Because that was the thing I was saying. When I hear someone saying something about singles, it isn't that I necessarily mean singles. It's that the thing where you're like, it's just, you're on top of it and you know it. It takes a little while to do that. But when you do, I think it's incredibly rewarding. There's Carol Keogh, she's doing two jobs here, okay? So half of the songs, roughly, are her standing on a mountain in a kind of a white, basically kind of a toga, and she's been blown, she's holding a sword, and she's singing this incredibly dramatic way, you know, like that's the music video. And then the other half of it is her, you know, in a little dimly lit theatre on stage with a spotlight.
See her curled up in a bedsit.
Yeah, she's holding a skull, and she's
and
like
a two-bar heater on.
singing to the, you know, like it's quite dramatic. A lot of it is, it's quite brave. It's like she's, I think the album is adventurous. I think it doesn't always get there. I think it's lyrically brave, and I think it doesn't always work. But I think that when it works, this is the most interesting. I think the best songs on this, I think it's too long. I think there's a lot of filler on it. I would cut off four or five songs. And one of the things I thought about it was there's a lot of closing tracks on it.
That's true.
A lot of songs you could have as the closing track of it, you know, that kind of epic, you know, drifting into the kind
and
of...
And here's another one. Yeah, like, there is a little bit of that for sure.
But
yeah.
I thought that Sea Change is the third last track. I would have ended it there. I think that would be fine. And there's one or two things like Sea Change Part 2 and the polar bits and the
polar
Doppler
magnets,
and,
yeah,
you know, over. And so like this couple I would have taken out. And the first track I think is unrepresentative, the last bus song. I don't think it's representative of it. But I think There's a song called Rogue Gene. There's a song called 256 Shades of Grey.
23C is good, I thought.
Yeah, and yeah. But there's a line in 256 Shades of Grey, and I think it's the third or fourth line. She's just kind of singing, and then she sings this little lilting kind of melody, which is the color of aquamarine. And I was walking along today, and I had heard it, and today that just stuck. I've been singing that little. It's a tiny little bit of a melody, but it just stuck in my head, and it just took me like a lot of listens for it to kind of embed, you know. And I think that's really interesting. I don't listen to a lot of albums that take work like this, and this took work.
Yeah. I definitely need to give it some more work because, and this is the really difficult thing about listening to music of an era retrospectively, because I found it really hard to separate. I really, really love Automata, and I love Carol's lyrics with Automata, and obviously I found it very hard to disassociate because it's the same voice, but quite different music. So I kind of struggled with separating that when trying to get into this album.
Well, she went on with Donal O'Mahony, who's in this band, to be in the Tycho Brahe, and they had a song called Defiance. And Defiance is one of my favourite Irish songs ever. It's Am I Not a Good Person?
You're not.
Thanks. But it's just one of the most incredible songs. And I wish there was a song that kind of accessible on this, because I think this album, you know, take off the two worst on and put two bangers on, like singles on it, if you know what I mean, and the rest of the album carries it and would give people an in. But it's like there's no in, you know, you're at a sheer rock face here.
It just feels a bit student, a bit lightweight, a bit student experimental. I mean, some of the records here, again, as I say, I mean, brought back to the late 90s in Dublin or my own student days, and there's a certain manic pixie girl quality to the songs that they're kind of like a dog whistle to me. But you know, as Elaine was saying, that as she went on in her career, I think she, you know, she matured, and I think that the songwriting got better, maybe the production got better, and with Alpha States, obviously, much stronger songs, and I think that it really suited her. She does have a very raw talent, and I think it's a bit too raw here for me. There's the makers of a great artist, which we were to find out later on. I don't think this is the album that's going to showcase that to the best.
I just wanted to just, there's a lyric on Rogue Gene, which is one of my favourites. If not my favourite, it's one of my favourites on the album. And the lyric in the verse is, I tire of people asking why, as a prelude to judgment, the killing kinds that give the lie to the politics of dysfunction. Is this the core of emptiness in each suburban district, or the anomaly of consciousness? You know,
that's a lot, okay?
Yeah. But no, my point is like, that is like, you know, to sing a lyric like that
she gets
means
away
something.
With it, though. This
and
is the thing.
To make it work, I think, is, I would so much prefer to hear someone going for something, you know, brave and ambitious and different and interesting, and it working, and then sometimes not working, than hear someone who has done lots of kind of safe stuff and it's always kind of working. You know, and so I think artistically you have to reference that. You have to say fair fucks.
I think what I'm hearing here is noble failure. Is that a fair way of putting it?
No,
because noble failure to me is,
not from him.
Noble failure to me, like, doesn't mean failure. It means that
I know what you're saying.
There's an awful lot of good here, but it doesn't quite coalesce.
Well, what's the point of releasing? I mean, let's strip it back a little bit. What you're trying to do is you're trying to write, you know, music that connects with people. And I think the best stuff on this is excellent. I think there's too much filler. I think there is almost, you know, I think there's 13 tracks. You know, I mean, I'm talking like 4 or 5, but I think the rest of it is really. I think there's a really, really good album here. It needs a snip across the board. But I think that, just imagine that's happened, and then you know what I mean? Just, okay, we've done that, and now this is excellent, you know?
Okay, well, we've done that album, and this has been excellent. So let's take a break. We'll come back and see if we can find some kind of champion from these 5 records. Okay, so how will we break this one down this time, Kieran?
Well, I think that, for me, I have 2. I think people should listen to The Prayer Boat and Polly Chanel. I think it's an underrated album. I don't hear people talking about it. I haven't heard the whispers in that Ed hears in his head about the album. I didn't know the album, and it wasn't something that...
It's incredible.
It wasn't something that came that I had experience of, so it was a real discovery for me, and I really think it's something to listen to. And I think the Plague Monkeys, Sunburn Insects. I don't think it's a perfect album, but I think the best parts of it elevated above the norm. So I think I will say the two of those.
Fair enough. Elaine Buckley.
It's 1999. If I'm going to get the 77A into town to spend £17.99 on an album, it is without a doubt The Frames Dance the Devil.
Okie doke. And why? I know you've expressed it, but just one more time for any of the heathens and skeptics out there.
I think it's if for the heathens and skeptics out there, I think it's a really accessible Frames album to listen to, because say perhaps if you've never seen them live before, which is a huge part of the Frames experience, it will make you want to. But also the more kind of quieter tracks, if they don't make you feel something, I think there's something wrong.
Did you hear that, Kieran? Something wrong.
Well, there's definitely something wrong.
Okay, Elaine May.
So I'm just going to back you up, essentially, what you said there. So I'm going to go for the Frames. And as someone who never really listened to them, I found it exactly like that, really accessible. And it kind of made me understand why people like them so much. And I listened to it the first time and I was like, yeah, it's cool. Like, I can kind of see, like, there's some interesting stuff in it. And then I listened to it again and I was like, okay, that sounds really catchy. And then I listened to it again and I was like, oh my God, this whole thing is so good. Like, so I think it really kind of drew me in. And like, I listened to it again on the way here and
You're a Frames fan.
I just thought it was really good. And then I would also say The Prayer Boat, I think, for anybody who I had never heard of them and I had never heard that album, and I just thought it was really beautiful as well. So I'd definitely give that a listen as well.
Boom.
Ed.
I'm going to follow suit. And I think, as a confessed cynic when it comes to the Frames, I really think that people, and the lazy cynicism that goes on in this country, and especially in the music scene centered on Dublin, is a very negative thing. And I think that I've fallen into that trap myself many times over the years. I have surrounded myself, not on purpose, with people who would speak so ill of Glenn Hansard. I'm surprised he doesn't drop dead at any juncture in his life. But that's unfair and it's lazy. And I think that the Frames, at their best, which you'll hear them in Dance the Devil, is an album that, with my revisionist history, well, it's 99 bucket hat on, is one that needs to be heard. And I think that there's an injustice has been done to the Frames over the years, as has been done to the Franks. I want to get a shout in for Beauty Becomes More Than Life, because there's much more to the Franks and then the singles would let you think.
So the Frames and the Franks.
Yeah.
Well summed up. Okay. I want to give a shout to the Plague Monkeys because I do really like it. I want to give a shout to the Prayer Boat because I think it's got a lot of charm. But, and I'm genuinely shocked, and I hate to sound like a broken record here after what has come before me, but if you had said to me, Dave, you're going to put a Frames record out there as you recommend, I would have said, not in a fucking million years, mate. But I am. The Frames Dance the Devil. I like it. And I think it is accessible. And it did kind of make me kind of wash off some of that cynicism. I reserve the right to still have a lot of criticisms, but, and I will not be suddenly turning around tomorrow and being like, best band ever, he's the greatest. But yeah, I really like the record, and I think that, especially if you're coming at it from my point of view, you might well be surprised. And so, the Frames, Dance the Devil.
We should be thankful the old triangle isn't on it.
Oh,
either,
Christ, so. Yeah.
I think it's one of the
for bonus that alone.
But we have 4 votes for the Frames. We've got 2 votes for the prayer, the prayer, but I'm going to give another vote, just another bonus vote in there.
Jesus.
I'm not. And Plague Monkeys won and Frank's won. So it looks like our recommended album from this episode is The Four of Us.
Oh, what? It's at the Russian Olympics.
Congratulations to The Four of Us. Jesus.
No, it's to the Frames. So as your album, which song would you like to play us out with?
I think God Loves Mom.
Good choice. God
okay,
I want to thank my whole panel because it's been great. Thank you guys for all coming in. I really appreciate it. It's been a good episode and yeah, a fucking good record. So we will play out with the Frames. See you next time.
keep you sad of the deal.
This podcast is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.